things back in the beginning. I want to go a little bit about what we know about the moon and measurements made and so on. So a little bit about the scientific side. And the second part, I want to create a timeline which led to the landing of humans on the moon. The moon being the only object in outer space other than Earth where humans set foot on. So the second part is maybe more fun because I tried to put as many video sequences in as I could find. And I will already apologize for the talk maybe being a little bit long because of those. So let's get started. The moon, easy to observe. This is one of my own pictures. I took with a little 2.5-inch telescope and a normal SLR camera. So it's very bright, it's big, it's something which always kind of fascinated humanity in culture. Here, for example, who doesn't know Jules Verne's famous book, From Earth to the Moon, or the movie version up here. The moon always kind of has also often fascinating fight being treated as deities or being assigned these mystical powers, turning people into werewolves and stuff like that. So it always has a fascinating place in culture. But let's start with more fact-based knowledge. So as I said, it's the brightest and largest object in the night sky. What the other bright and large object would be the sun, but it's not in the night sky. It's the fifth largest moon in the solar system. We have over 200 moons in the solar system around various planets. Most of the planets actually have moons. And it's after Ganymede, Titan, Callisto, Io, Ganymede, Callisto, Io being Jupiter, Titan, Saturn. This is the fifth largest moon. The mass is about an 1/18 of the mass of Earth. The size 1/4 of the radius of Earth. Mean density 60% of the density of Earth. And surface gravity is only 1/6 of what we have here on Earth, and that makes for these funny images where the astronauts are jumping around on moon because they have so much lighter, they can with the same strength pull. Jump my time. Volume is about a fifth, 50th of Earth, and surface temperatures are extreme. They can vary between 100 Kelvin, which is about -279 Fahrenheit in shaded area, to up to 390 Kelvin or 242 Fahrenheit in areas illuminated by the sun. And this is important. Moons do not emit light themselves. What we see is reflected from the sunlight. And the low temperature here on this, and that's also important later for when we are asking the question, can we find water on the moon? The distance of our moon to Earth is about 385,000 kilometers, and that's the mean distance. Since the orbit around Earth is slightly elliptical, not very strong, but slightly elliptical, it varies between 362,000 at the lowest and 405,000 at the furthest point. The orbit is about 27.3 days. That's the sidereal month, which means that in retrospect to the sun. While the synodic month, meaning with respect to the sun, is a little bit longer, it's about 29.5 days, and that's why we get these different moon phases. Orbital speed slightly over 1 kilometer per second, and again that varies due to the elliptical orbit. And if you see here the animation of the orbit around the Earth in the center, the purple lines represent the orbit. And then you see numbers varying down here. That's the orbital speed, that's the distance. And due to Kepler's second law, then moon is at the smallest distance, it has a high orbital speed and at the largest distance it has the lowest orbital speed. So we see the moon in all kinds of phases, from new moon, that's when it is directly between Earth and the Sun, or all the way to full moon. And one of the reasons we see these phases is also the orbital inclination of 5 degrees. So it's not a flat orbit plane parallel to Earth. No, it's slightly inclined, and that's why we see it nicely fully illuminated. Another fact we identified is we actually see more than only half of the moon. So if you project a sphere on a two-dimensional surface, you would expect you see exactly half of that sphere, right? But that's actually not true, since the moon has what we call libration, meaning it's rocking back and forth, and that is because the moon is actually lopsided, and we come to this a little bit later again. And it has an elliptical and inclined orbit. We see this wobbling of the moon, and that wobbling back and forth that lets us see about 60% of it, so a little bit more than half. Here's an even better version, new data from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, really high resolution images of the moon. And you also see one nice effect when you follow this. You see how all these craters become visible when the night day line is moving over them. That's actually the best time to observe these features. So if you want to with a small telescope see something on the surface of the moon, the best is you choose a time, like for example today, we have roughly half moon, and then you can nicely see along this dividing line craters and mountain features. Another effect is a gravitational effect between Earth and moon, and that means that our moon is tidally locked. Often people ask, because we always see the same side of the moon, does the moon not rotate? No, it does rotate. And the reason why we can say it rotates is because it's tidally locked. Because if you look at the left side here, the tidally locked case, and you see how that side always points towards what would be Earth, you see how that rotates around this, also its own axis while it goes around. While if it would not, if the moon would not rotate around its own axis, we would always see a different side of the moon pointing towards Earth. So, tidally locked is actually something which is very common with moons in the solar system. Most of the moons show these effects, especially in the, around Jupiter and Saturn, so a very common occurrence. Gravitational effects of the moon on Earth, we all know them, the tides, which means that the moon is pulling on Earth. And what happens is we have an effect called differential gravity. That means that the gravitational pull is stronger on one side than on the other. And that pulls differently on different elements. And for example, here we have another scenario where we also include the Sun, which also creates a little bit of a tidal pull on the Moon-Earth system. And this pull leads to the water surface being stretched, and water being easier to stretch than solid rock. That's where we see most of these effects, by changing water level. Yeah. And the effect is strongest when we either have new moon or full moon. That's when we have the spring tide, and it's lowest when we have the first and third quarter moon, meaning we have this right angle between moon, Earth, and Sun. That's when we have the so these tides, as I said, they pull on the water body and they kind of deform it a little bit. But what that also means that our solid rock, which doesn't get as much deformed, is rotating under this water body. And we have some form of friction between the water and the rotating Earth. What that means is it's actually slowing down the rotation of Earth. And this rotation energy, which is released, which due to the slowdown, where does that go? Now, that gets transferred to the Moon. Because we have something in physics called conservation of angular momentum. Energy cannot be lost. It needs to be transferred into something. And that means the Moon speeds up while Earth's rotation slows down. And the Moon starts spiraling outward. And that spiraling is about 4 centimeters per year. And that means days on Earth get longer. So 400 million years ago, for example, our days were only 22 hours long. A billion years, 18 hours. Not a lot of free time if you have to work an 8-hour shift. So, what do we know about the lunar surface? Since we only see the near side of the Moon, most of what we know about the back side has actually come from satellite missions in the last 50 years. And so what we know is we have these different features, like we have a lot of craters, especially on the back side of the Moon. There is almost only craters. We have on the front side, we have these smooth areas like here called Mare. They are smooth and dark. And then we have these really bright highland areas. They are rough and highly reflective. From the first Moon mission, from Apollo and so on, we know that almost all of the rocks you can find on the surface of the Moon are cooled lava, so they are igneous. And when we compare Moon and Earth structure, then we see that they have similar chemistry, but there are a big difference, especially in abundance. And as I said, many of these results came from the Apollo missions. Apollo collected and brought back about 840 pounds of moon rock and dust. And it's still guarded as a treasure. It's highly secured in very controlled environment. It's mainly held on nitrogen, not oxygen, to prevent humidity rise. And you cannot directly touch it, except for a few samples which are in museums and which are specifically designed for touch. Even scientists who want to work with them have to work indirectly through glass and everything in field environment. Here are three examples. The little boxes here actually indicate how these rocks were found on the moon surface. So we have the directions on the sky, north, east, south, west, and then up and bottom and top. So this one actually faced north. This side here faced north when it was found. This side here faced up, so it was on the top when the rock was. So how are these smooth areas, these Mare, formed on the moon? Now, some indications came, especially in recent years, from missions like GRAIL, which is a gravity recovery in interior laboratory, that's what the acronym stands for, which measures gravitation, or differences in the gravitational field. And what they identified here is one of these maps, is these kind of plumbing systems, they call it. These are rifts. And the idea goes that these rifts help the lava flow to fill the basins which were created by earlier impacts of comets or asteroids and filled them with lava, and this lava then cooled and created these smooth, darker areas. We see these mainly only on the near side. One of the reasons I will explain a little bit later, but it came also from recent measurements. What expected before is the thickness of the crust of the moon. It's different between the far and the near. So these active, these volcanic active eras ended about 3.5 billion years ago. And ever since the lava has cooled and has come to the smooth dark areas we see today. Right now, the moon is relatively quiet geologically. Here is an artist's impression of how one of these Mares, the Mare Imbrium, has formed. So we have first a big impact of some form of asteroid or something. These impacts produce shock waves. And these shock waves then lead to volcanic eruptions. And then we have with these eruptions lava flowing, and the more lava is flowing, the more these regions fill up. And in this case, 1,300 kilometer large basin filled up with lava and created this large dark area. So, as I said, near-side mainly large mares, and the name Mare actually came from ancient times when people thought these regions were seas on the moon, and they gave them the name Mare from the Latin word for sea. Nowadays we know these are lava-filled basins. The far side mainly impact craters. This here, these two images are relatively recent images from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is a high-resolution imager which orbits the moon. And the reason, as I mentioned before, is that the crust is thicker on the far side and therefore prevented, even with these impacts, prevented lava from actually reaching the surface and filling. Our knowledge about the composition of the lunar surface mainly comes from Apollo missions or recent satellites. So we know that lunar density is about 3.3 grams per cubic centimeter, which is comparable to the Earth's mean density. We also know, and that's different to Earth, that Moon has a deficiency in iron. If we look at lunar rocks and the soil, we see that the abundance of these elements is different to what we have here. And here for is one of these missions which helped identifying these properties. It's RAIL. It's actually a twin satellite. And this is a model of technology, because these satellites fly in perfect synchronized ways, so that whenever gravitational changes from the moon changes the speed of one of the two satellites, they can measure this and translate that into a change of gravity on the moon surface. And it's amazing how precise these satellites can be flown. Now what they came up with is maps like this here, and I'm really sorry, it's a little bit small, but it goes from here, the blue is about 10 kilometers thickness, to the white being 60 kilometers, and you see that this as the near side of the moon is about 20 to 30 kilometers thick crust, while on the far side of the moon we have almost twice as thick. So we know that the lunar interior is differentiated, exactly like Earth's interior. So we have layers; it's not just one big block. The core is properly molten, so the layers are we have our surface layer outside, which is usually thin between 30 and 60 kilometers, depending on far or near side. mantle, which is this homogeneous air here. And then we go into a partially melted part, and followed by fluid outer core and a solid inner core. These are most likely iron cores, similar to Earth. However, they are very small compared to the cores we have in Earth or see in other planets. Only about 20% of the moon's size. Now, let me go one step back. The difference in thickness also is what creates the loop size. So that's why we have this also. It's one effect leading to the back and forth rocking of the moon we see. Okay, so the question, or one of the important questions always is there water on the moon? If we ever want to have a chance of colonizing the moon permanently, we need water. That's important. So many have tried to figure that out, and one of the important missions dealing with this question is, for example, Clementine in 1994, who met the moon during a flyby. So the mission had two goals. One was mapping the moon, the other was mapping an asteroid. And so the flyby, they got these maps, high resolution maps in all kinds of wavelength bands, from the ultraviolet to infrared and also radar altimetry, so using radar signals. And what they found is actually they found shady areas. And shady areas, so areas which never see sunlight, are important because that's where your temperature stays around 100 Kelvin. And that means that's where ice, water ice, would be able to survive millions of years. Another mission was Lacrosse. It's a more recent mission which flew together with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which also was trying to answer that question. And what people did with Lacrosse was, so from these earlier missions, we identified areas where we have shade, where water ice could survive. And here, for example, this is an illumination map over 1 month, or you could also call that one lunar day. And you see how there are areas which are always dark. These are areas where sunlight doesn't reach the ground. And these are preferred targets to search for water ice. Now, what Lacrosse did, or what it was, is in principle, it's a two-part satellite, and it went on an orbit which directed it towards the pole, and the first part of the satellite was deemed as an impactor, which would impact into the South Pole in one of these shady areas. And then the second part, this part here, so this would be the impactor, and this part here then would fly through the plume and the ejecta coming off from that impact and measuring and analyzing the composition and searching for signatures of water ice. So here you see how these two separate, the Shepard satellite, how it is called, positions itself as the instrument towards the moon. And then down here you have another animation how that was supposed to go. So you see how the impact, you create this big plume, and the Shepard flies through that plume and analyzes data. Now here, these are actually images from the Shepard, and I'm not sure if you can see this very clearly, but here it's very faint. You see a ring appearing and getting bigger and bigger here. Can you see this? This is the actual ejecta and plume from the impact. The scientists were surprised because they expected a much brighter room, but unfortunately it wasn't, and they had to actually digitally enhance the images before even seeing anything on them. But anyway, so the impact happened on October 9, 2009, about 11:30 UTC. The Shepard spacecraft descended successfully through the impact of what's called Centauri, through that ejecta, and on November 13, 2009, NASA announced that they had evidence of the presence of water in both the plume and the ejecta of the Centaur satellite. So, yes, there is water ice on the moon. Lunar atmosphere, often people think that the moon doesn't have any atmosphere at all, and it's almost right, but it has a little tiny thin atmosphere. So, and the reason why it's not such a thick atmosphere like we enjoy here on Earth is the temperatures can get pretty high on the surface of the moon, and the gravity is pretty low. That is a perfect recipe for molecules to escape the gravitational field of the moon and get ejected, and the atmosphere evaporates out, so it leaks away. So if we compare it with Earth, so we have about 10 to the 6 or 1 million molecules per cubic centimeter, while here on Earth we have 10 to the 19th molecule per cubic centimeter at sea level. So much stronger atmosphere. This is comparable to what the Earth's atmosphere is out at where the International Space Station lies. So what we would consider actually already almost outer space. There were several experiments dealing with the atmospheric condition. One was employed by Apollo 17, the last of the Apollo mission. And that here this the experiment set up, and with that experiment the team was able to identify helium, argon, neon, and several other molecular species and elements in and around the moon. So here this is an image from taken from Earth. You see how the moon is blended out in the center to not overglow the whole image, and then people try to search for emission around the moon, and were able to find a sodium glow almost out to 8 lunar radians. So what do we think how the moon has formed? And if we take all the knowledge together, then the best model which appears is that Earth had collided with an object roughly 1 to 2 times the size of Mars in its very early stage. Both were protoplanetary stage. That collision led to the ejection of material in gaseous form, maybe mixed in some liquids and solid, and that material stayed in a disk around Earth, and over time it coalesced into what we call now the moon, and then the moon started slowly to spiral outward due to the tide on Earth, due to the friction I described. So that is roughly what we know. There's much more. I could give 10 of those talks to go in all of the details. But since we have the 50th anniversary of actually landing on the moon, I thought it's also the fun part and looking a little bit into how we got there. So the exploration part of the moon. Now, it all started in the 50s. There were many unsuccessful missions trying to get any form of satellite to the moon. The first successful ones were in 59, flown by the Soviets, with Luna 1, 2, and 3, and they were the first moon flyby. They had the first impact on the moon, and they also transmitted the first image of the backside of the moon. Not sure if I don't have been able to identify anything, or maybe or a few of these dark features, but it was an accomplishment to be able to fly by the moon, take a look on the backside, and actually send information back. The first successful American mission was also in 59, and that was Pioneer 4, one of the many Pioneer satellites over the years which studied the solar system and beyond. And that satellite was equipped with a Geiger-Müller counter and was looking for the radiation coming from the moon. And it also had a photographic experiment on board that was supposed to be triggered when the satellite reaches a distance to the surface of 30,000 kilometers. Unfortunately, it never reached that distance, so successful, it was only partially successful. It was that satellite was able to measure or look for radiation. It couldn't detect any, which was a good find, if you want to go there. But unfortunately, the imaging part failed. Now, the thing heated up in the 60s, to mid-60s, with the Ranger program. So you have to consider, if you want to go to an object in outer space, you've never been there. No one has never been there. So you have no idea about conditions, about surface. Is there even the opportunity to land? Is the ground stable enough to support a lander? Can we get a lander back? This was all not known by the beginning of the 60s. So the Ranger program was actually designed to change that. And the first few iterations of the Ranger were not very successful, but with Ranger 7, they finally got it together and flew at least three successful missions. And here you see some of the, well, here's an image of the satellite itself. These three missions together sent about 17,000 images back to Earth. Here, the first close-up image provided by Ranger 7, and here you see some TV imaging of the approach to the moon. Now, in 66, the Russians had another successful mission with Luna 9 and 10, and that was the first landing on the moon. So that was the first time humanity could prove, yes, it is possible to land something on the moon. And here you see the first image from the lunar surface. And with Luna 10, they actually created the first man-made object which orbited another body in outer space. Not just our own Earth, but another body in outer space. So you have to get it from Earth to somewhere else, and then inject it into an orbit around them, which is no easy task to do. In 66, the Surveyor mission started, and they were designed to actually really prep for the upcoming lunar landing for the Apollo mission. So they were first, they had to prove that the soft landing is possible, that Americans can softly land something on the moon. And that was done by Luna, by Surveyor 1. Here you see, I think that's a very famous image where Surveyor 1 photographs its own shadow from the moon. Then a second program, the Lunar Orbiter, was also started in 66, which orbited the moon, as the name said. There were several variations of this. And then mapped the lunar surface as good as possible. By accident, they overtook this famous image, an Earth right over the lunar horizon. The first time that we saw the Earth as seen from a different body in the solar system. Now, Lunar Orbiter 1, the mission was to map our 9 potential landing sites, plus 11 sites on the far side of the moon. It carried a camera, Eastman Kodak camera, which weighed about 150 pounds. And that camera could scan in, develop the film. At that time, we still had film to develop. We couldn't just simply send our pictures via wireless somewhere. So they had to develop that film in space, scan it in, and send back the digitized version of the images. So that's quite an achievement. And interestingly, that camera was actually designed to fly on spy satellites. So in total, it returned 200 images and finished about 580 orbits around the moon. Good achievement. The Lunar Orbiter and Surveyor program went on. They mapped more sites, returned more images of the moon. They deployed additional instruments, for example, here micro-metroid detectors. It's a very high risk when you fly a satellite in outer space, micro-meteorites. Meteorites, larger ones, easy to identify and you might avoid them, but the little stuff, which has high speed and which can damage very severely your spacecraft, that's important to know how much you have to expect in the vicinity of where you want to land. Surveyor, they did a few more engineering flights. They proved the feasibility of the moon landing. They employed a certain experiments like TV cameras. They even sampled the surface. They had a kind of a hook system where they could dig trenches in the moon and dig up material and measure how much the surface can withstand. Dust detection, they also analyzed on board of Surveyor 7 the dust. In total, they sent back about 80,000 images and were a big support program for the Apollo mission. So now, that was all the prelude, and then the actual run for the moon started with the Apollo program. Here you see the mission batches of all 17 or of all Apollo missions. The first Apollo mission was a tragedy. And there was an accident on board of the rocket during a countdown simulation. Fire spread within the command module, and because of the design of the command module at the time, the three astronauts, Virgil Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee, were not able to escape and unfortunately lost their lives. There was a big a congressional report on what happened, and it led to redesign of many of the features of the command module, for example, the way the doors open. The atmosphere in the capsule was 100% oxygen, which led to the fire rapidly expanding. That was changed, and they infused it with nitrogen. And a few other things which were redesigned. Apollo 1 was designated to be the first crew manned mission. That was didn't happen. There was no Apollo 2 and 3 designation assigned. So the Apollo program picked up with Apollo 4, and Apollo 4, 5, and 6 were engineering missions, unmanned, to test the rockets and so on. The first manned mission was Apollo 7. Was flown by Walter Schirra, Don Eisley, and Walter Cunningham. And this was the first crewed Earth orbit test mission for Apollo. So they took the Apollo command module and sent it into an orbit around Earth to test if the principle works. The first of the more famous Apollo missions was Apollo 8. Flown by Borman, Lovell, and Anderson. And they were the first ones to actually fly to the moon and orbit the moon. They were the first humans to orbit a body beyond Earth. The first humans to observe Earth from a distance, and the first crew flight to the moon. And here's a few of the videos.
That's the official list. Hey, I'll take that. I'm scheduled.
Scrambling to actually get it photographed. That's the model of the small module. Windows in the capsule, and they got a second check. Now that is so. In the background, you see reconstruction using LRO data, but this overlay here, that's the original image data. So after Apollo 8, which was a huge success. There was Apollo 10, and this was kind of the stage rehearsal for the moon landing. So what they did, so Stafford, Young, and Dennis, I think I pronounced that correct, they flew to the moon with the lander on board, or actually a model of the lander. It was not one-to-one the lander. It was heavier than the lander which would be used by Apollo 11. And what they did is they descended towards the moon, all the way down to, I think, 47,000 feet.
Before the landing gear has prepared to undock from the command module. On direction from mission control, a short burn of the service module's small engines was initiated to separate the lunar module from its mothership. The two spacecraft moved 30 feet apart and maintained station heating for 1.5 hours, while the command module pilot maneuvered the spacecraft around the lunar module to visually inspect its exterior. Then, with all systems in order and functioning as planned, the lunar module's descent engine was fired to place it into a descent trajectory. This brought the lunar module down to an altitude of 47,000 feet, or about 9 miles above the Sea of Tranquility, the closest man has ever been to the lunar surface.
Well, I actually would not want to have been one of those. Being within 9 miles of the lunar surface, being in a vehicle which actually descends down, and not being able to do it, and they were speculating if they would descend all the way down, but since the module was not the one used for landing in Apollo 11, it was heavier, they could not have landed. But what they were able to do, they were actually testing everything for the big thing, for the next mission, and that was Apollo 11 with famous Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins. Here you see the crew picture of the three of them. The mission started in Cape Canaveral on July 16th, 1969. I remember because my mother was pregnant with me at the time. I've been born roughly a month later. From Complex 39A, if someone, I don't know if that has a meaning to someone. The launch vehicle was a Saturn V rocket. You see the rocket here launching. And it carried the command and service module, Columbia, and the lunar module, Eagle. It reached the lunar orbit on July 19th and landed on the moon on July 20th, 1969. and then they departed from the lunar surface and returned safely to Earth on July 24th. And here a few more videos about that moon landing. So on July 18th, Armstrong and Aldrin entered the lunar model, so Eagle, and for inspection. That was the first time there were TV transmissions. I unfortunately could not find a clean video sequence, so I did not include that. But what you see in these two here is the Apollo Command module called Extract the Lunar Model before flying towards the moon, and then down here you see from Columbia how Eagle separates and starts to descend to the lunar surface. And that was on July 20th. The lunar orbit insertion maneuver was July 19th. Then I see the little rock here, that's when they actually contact each other, and then it pulls it out of the stage from the Saturn V and passes its way to the moon. Down here you see how Eagle is descending down to the moon. The Eagle has landed, famous word, right? Here you see this is redone using high resolution imaging and then audio and the video. So here you see the original.
You're looking great, coming up 9 minutes. Well, I'm your approach phase, everything looking good. Now the 250-200 feet.
Thank you. 69.
15 MPs. I guess you're about the only person around that doesn't have TV coverage of the food.
The lander as much energy as possible by not freezing to death. So I think that was one of the most successful missions by not accomplishing it. But yeah, you had follow-up landings, Apollo 12, for example, which landed close to one of the surveyor satellites, and they walked over there and took that photo. Then with Apollo 16, they even brought the car to the lunar surface, and that significantly extended the range they could move on the lunar surface. And then the last mission, Apollo 17, that was the first time actually a scientist went to the moon. Before they were all pilots, engineers, soldiers, but this was a scientific geologist who went with the last mission to the moon. Let's skip over this. There are in recent years there are much more activity, especially in the 2010s. The Chinese, it becomes more and more international now. Chinese, India, Israel, Europe—they all send their satellites to the moon, landers, all different sorts of things. Here you see a map of different landing sites over the years I described. And I think if we want to go back to the moon, the first thing we have to do is send out a cleanup crew there and get rid of all this stuff. That is littered. Yeah, so I hope you enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. And I'll leave you with this final, very famous. That was up, the crew of Apollo 8. Their mission was in December, and they reached the moon right before Christmas and sent these famous words back. Thank you for being here tonight, and I hope to see you again next year.